Hey, Gmote fans, just a few things I wanted to talk about before we get to the episode. One, thank you for sticking with us for a two-part episode and release schedule this week. I'm hopeful that the more content from us will be welcomed by all of you, and I appreciate if you are now listening to both parts this week. Second, if you liked our preview here, Dana asked me to set up a live stream the Monday after the Oscars, starting at 7:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. So that is Monday the 11th, 7:30 p.m. Central Standard Time on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/@GMotePodcast. You have to include the at there to make sure that you get that. I've got a lot of great topics to cover that night, including Oscars reaction and my live annual Best Picture rankings release, so I hope you'll tune in for that. And in addition to Dana and myself, we're going to be having a few new faces added to the show just for you guys. Andrew Korns of the Revisionist Almanac will be on with us making his Gmote debut, as well as the hosts of Never Seen It with Betsy and Trent Gorham. So it should be a great live stream. If you can't catch it live, that's okay. I will probably throw up the whole unedited discussion on our audio feed after we're done, but you can also catch it on our YouTube channel after the fact, and again, that is youtube.com/@GMotePodcast. Have to include the at. Again, we'll be live at 7:30 p.m. Central Standard Time that night on March 11th, 2024, for any of you who want to slide into the live chat as we're going during that. Also, we're going to be debuting a new segment during that show, Ask Dana Anything. If you didn't see the call for questions on our social media feeds for Instagram and X, you can still submit questions either in the comments on any of those platforms or any of our socials, or in the anonymous question link we had there. You can also submit questions to greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com if you want to have Dana answer anything. I'll be honest, the more obnoxious the question, the more he will likely enjoy it. So get some of those in for the live show. Finally, a big thank you to our friends this year that we've come to know and grow with: Andrew Korns of the Revisionist Almanac, Adam Hitchcock of the Streaming Circuit, and also the Revisionist Almanac, Kieran B. of the Best Picture Cast, and Shane Rogers of Midnight Facts for Insomniacs. We're very grateful to you all and the relationships we've developed with each of you this year. We're so glad that three of you so far are in our Five Timers Club and got your hats already, and I'm sure Andrew won't be far behind. I know several of you are already going to be working, if not accomplishing, your t-shirts by the end of the year with 10 visits on the feed, but thank you, thank you, thank you. Also, a big thank you to all of you who support the show worldwide. We've now been in 118 countries as a show, and we are continually blown away by the reach we've had. If any of you out there would like to be a guest upcoming, here are just a few of the movies that we don't have anyone signed up for yet that are coming this year and next. So for 2024, The Natural, Midnight Cowboy, Chinatown, Easy Rider, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The Sixth Sense, The Life of Brian, Anatomy of a Murder, Joker, Parasite, Ben-Hur, and Magnolia. And then for 2025, The Breakfast Club, Toy Story, Patton, Gladiator, Inside Out, The Apartment, Inception, The Night of the Hunter, Seven, All About Eve, The Lost Weekend, and Raging Bull, just to name a few. So write us either at our email address, the show website, ronnieduncanstudios.com/GMotePodcast, or find us on any of our socials, X, YouTube, Letterboxd, Instagram, TikTok, or Facebook at the handle @GMotePodcast. Thanks again, and without further ado, here are our Best Picture rankings for the 2024 Oscars. This podcast may contain explicit language. Welcome to the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast, the show that uses a unique grading style to redefine what the greatest movies are. I'm Tom Duncan.
And I'm Dana Duncan.
So when we left you on Wednesday, we had ran over our normal time, and we wanted to still include our Best Picture rankings, but I decided that a part two was a little bit better of an idea. So we have two releases this week, and coming at you tonight, we give you our fourth annual Oscar preview Best Picture rankings. So for part one was mostly based on what should and will win for each of us and our opinions, as well as our bad movie bet. Just a recap on that. We only differentiated on three categories. Our tiebreaker was also given in part one. So if you want to listen to that, go back to our part one, which was earlier on the feed this week. But now we are going to our best picture rankings. Just a reminder here before we get started. Here are your best picture nominees for the year 2023. American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, and The Zone of Interest. So as we always do, we will start from 10 to 1, and we will go kind of in a back and forth manner. So if both of us have the same 10, we will discuss that movie at that point. And if we don't, we will wait until both of us have said that film in a particular rankings order. So, Dad, at number 10, who do you have?
I have Poor Things. I did not get it. I don't understand
it. Hold on. I do not have it at 10, so you're going to have to hold. I have Maestro at 10.
Okay.
So what is your number 9?
I have Maestro.
All right. So here we'll discuss Maestro then. You may lead if you would like.
Okay, I will. It was interesting. It was enjoyable. It was a decent movie. It should have been nominated probably within the 10 categories, but it's not a great movie. It kind of left you emotionally hollow. I didn't understand at times why the story was presented the way it was, and I don't know. I just didn't find it to be that engaging.
So we watched it between, I think, Christmas and New Year's, or maybe like a New Year's Eve or something like that. And I know that for a lot of people, this wasn't what they expected. I think everybody, when this was announced with Bradley Cooper doing a biopic of a historical character, everybody assumed it would be Oscar Beatty, and that because of the success of A Star Is Born and somewhat of the rancor, the backlash for that not winning over Green Book that year, I wonder if there were too many expectations placed on this. To me, this was not a well-told story. It doesn't answer the so what, why we needed to necessarily know about this person. I think for the most part, Leonard Bernstein as a character, as a figure, you can learn a lot about, but for the most part, I think he's most cherished for his music. And in the scenes where we got him operating at what the level was of his music, I thought this movie was actually good in those moments, like when he's instructing individual characters or when he's doing the 6-minute consecutive one-shot conduction scene. But in between, and between the relationship, even though I thought the two lead performances were good, I just didn't understand what I was supposed to get out of this movie. And it doesn't answer that so what question. Why do I need to know this story? Why do I need to know about this person in a way that other films this year, I thought, answered that question a lot better?
To be quite honest, everything I needed to know about Leonard Bernstein from this film, I could have gotten by reading a Wikipedia page.
And that's what I feel for a lot of biopics. So unfortunately, it falls into that trap. All right. So I had Maestro at 10. You had Maestro at 9. My number 9, oddly enough, which I would not have expected when I went into this, but the second time I watched it, even though I liked it as much as I did somewhat the first time, it just doesn't seem as profound as it was the first time, particularly when I wasn't in a theater surrounded by people in pink. I have Barbie at 9.
I have Barbie at 8.
All right, so let's discuss it here.
Okay, to me, the part about Barbie was the moment in time when we looked at each other and realized how much mansplaining we'd been doing.
Yeah, I know. I had like a weird horror flashback with the, let me mansplain The Godfather to you. You haven't seen The Godfather?
Yeah. Okay, so once that shock of pointing the finger at us wore off, the impact of the film was less.
I think it did its intended job. It was a very popular film, but it pointed out what I think to a degree was some rather obvious things that while yes, we've come very well, I guess I'm not the judge of how far we've come or how not far we've come, since I am obviously a man. So I'll leave that discussion for somebody else. But in the discussion of things and how they've changed and how they haven't changed, it points out some rather obvious things where the progression of the Barbie and the history of the Barbie can be told through the history of feminism. But it doesn't mean that if we're just going to mention things that are on the surface, while that's crowd pleasing and entertaining, and I don't fault it for it, like I don't hate the movie in any regard, it doesn't seem as profound as it might have felt the first time I watched it and some of those things were being pointed out. And so it's a fun movie. I could see myself probably rewatching this at some point in time, although I wonder if its cultural impact will just wane very, very quickly and age even worse because the Barbie's just not relevant anymore. And even though we had this like cultural moment, I just don't know if, because dolls are just not as played with anymore as like iPads for kids, if it's just not going to live up to 10 years down the road being anything other than Greta Gerwig, Margot Robbie, and Ryan Gosling. Anytime you're in something, basically take my money.
I think what the point of the movie was is slapping a label and saying we're now sensitive to something does not mean it to be so. For example, simply saying that we have affirmative action in our admissions policy, therefore we've ended racism in universities, or we've now eliminated offensive names from sports teams in our league, so therefore we're no longer racist. You know, and I think, you know, the fact that Barbie kept portraying that, well, we're not sexist because Barbie can be a lawyer, or Barbie can be a Supreme Court justice, or Barbie can be a doctor. You know, I think that was part of the film that had some poignancy, but I'm kind of curious as to see how the other Mattel movies that are supposedly coming out over the next 12 to 24 months do.
Oh, they'll all be terrible. I think the only reason this did well is you had the right person write something that they felt that they had a story that they needed to tell. And it did, for me, answer the so what question. It's just comparative to some of the other films that are above it. I just don't feel it has the same depth or emotional resonance as I got out of some of the other films. You know, that's fine. This is the popular movie that would get its due in that type of situation. I'm just fine with this being a nominee and getting some nominations, but it's not destined to do anything more. If there is anything where there's some emotional depth, and I think this is probably a weird thing to say, so I'm going to be very careful treading this way, it's seeing the hard-headedness of men react in a world where women are given some equal or greater chances for the first time, and Ken actually is the more important performer during the course of the film in how he is going to make his way into a newer world where, you know, he now knows the dichotomy. Yes, we start off in Kenland where he's fine being subservient and, oh, if Barbie just notices me on a day, that makes my day. But once he gets his Mojo Dojo Casa House and the Kens take over, and then he realizes, well, that's not what I want necessarily either. How does he make his way in the world where there's more of an equal playing field again? And so I think the more complex character is actually Gosling and Ken than it is ever about the feminist film, because that all just seems somewhat surface level. To me, if you're getting any emotional depth, and maybe it's through the lens of I'm a man, so okay, fine, but that's what I saw in the film. All right, I think we're up to my 8, and I have done another audible in the moment. So I turned in a ballot earlier with a different number 8, and just now I'm realizing I was wrong. And part of the reason that I'm doing this audible is I had my bottom 2 locked in for a while. I had my top 3 locked in for a while, but I have reordered 4 through 8 probably 25 times, and I just did it again. So 8, I have Killers of the Flower Moon.
Okay.
So what is your 7?
My 7 is actually Killers of the Flower Moon.
All right, let's talk about it.
I was so looking forward to this movie. But first off, as I've said, putting the casting was a problem for me. Because why am I drawing?
All right, I'll put this out there. I love Leonardo DiCaprio. Trying to see him play stupid didn't work for me.
Trying to see him play 15 years younger than he is didn't work for me.
All right. And I know that was your reaction coming out of the theater. So I will give you credit going back to October with that one. But yeah, he's probably too old for this part. Although I will say that it ages over time. So by the end of the movie, he is the correct age. But they didn't really de-age him down young enough where you could buy him in his 20s when you could originally. This is one where it's kind of the opposite, where I probably would have bought him more playing the Aviator now and take his performance in the Aviator at that age and put it in this movie, basically switch him at both ages and see if they're different movies. But okay, point taken. To me, I was one of the people who enjoyed the ending. I don't know if everybody did. I know that it was kind of a shock to see it portrayed as this kind of like tongue-in-cheek towards podcasts and like murder historical type of serial like podcast episodic stuff. But I actually thought the medium in which it was told, if you were going to do that for your ending, would have been much more satisfying had this actually been done as a TV series. And I know people will say that, no, then just watch the movie. I don't mind that it's 3.5 hours if the movie flows. But this thing dragged for me in so many spots. And that's why I said you could cut out 45 minutes. But I'm saying in the mode that it was delivered, if you were going to have that intentional ending, podcasts are done episodically when you're doing those like season long arcs and you're doing a particular murder file investigation or a historical murder type of show. So honestly, this would have worked better for me if this is like a 4-part series and then that's the ending and you get that surprise. I thought that payoff would have actually worked better, even though I didn't mind it as the cinematic ending. But it's a little overbroad. It's a little overlong. It reverses the point of view in a way that I guess I didn't buy into. Like it wasn't distracting for me per se. But when this movie was originally announced, and I think the way it was originally supposed to be written was Jesse Plemons was originally supposed to be, I think, the DiCaprio role, and DiCaprio was supposed to be the Plemons role. And so it was supposed to be much more of the cop going after the bad guy type of story, and they reversed the perspectives. And while I don't mind that, I just don't think it was as effective as some other ways of telling this story. So from a formatting, a delivery, a pace situation, this is probably one that I know I'm against the grain because there are a lot of people that hold this like in the same category as Oppenheimer, or if not equal, very, very close. But it just didn't work for me, and I'm sorry.
Well, I kept saying over and over again that it was kind of like Goodfellas met Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that assessment because I also said that Dances with Wolves could cut probably a good 45 minutes to an hour out of that film and be much better.
Well, it didn't tell the story really from as much of the perspective as of the Native Americans as it should have. And it basically looked at it through the eyes of the criminals. I don't know. I don't understand the reasoning why Scorsese decided to do it the way he did. But he's a great director, and I'm just a guy doing a podcast from Central Wisconsin. So, but still, I can tell you what I say.
He's got more film knowledge in his eyebrows than I have in my entire being ever. So,
yeah.
So that's Killers of the Flower Moon. Okay, I think we are up to my number 7, and I have American Fiction.
It's my number 6.
All right, let's talk about it.
Good film, interesting film, important film, rather boring at times. I think it had a lot to say, but had trouble saying it.
You said important film. That's the only designation where I would say I disagree. I think just because we're telling a black film that doesn't need by itself necessitate importance. I liked the movie, but it other than the portion where we were getting the comedic interjection of what it is to be black and the stereotypes of, I guess, lampooning the writing industry, I didn't feel it to be as important as probably the marketing campaign told us it should be. And that's why I think the first time I watched it, I was kind of disappointed. I mean to say a word. The second time I watched it, I enjoyed it a lot more because I knew what the film was and I could watch it much more for the nuances and the small things of the family drama, which worked a lot better. But I thought what the movie was from the trailer was a different movie than what we actually got. And it was a much more quiet family drama where the family portion of things was much more important to the story than how it was sold and what the premise was that we got in all the trailers, where he's selling this book that he's trying to poke fun at everybody by writing the most over the top stereotypical thing. While I respect it, it's just, it's seven in a year where I think we have a lot of good movies, but you know, like I said, 4 through 8 could be a hodgepodge of different things. I've had them all over. I've had Killers up as high as 4, and now I had it at 8 in our official thing. I've had American Fiction higher and lower, and I ended up at 7.
Okay, when I say important film, you misconstrue. This is not a black film. This is a white guilt film. This is a film that pokes fun at what I used to call years ago drive-by liberal. It was like the people that went on the Beltline around D.C. and looked at the slums and said, we need to do something about that. And they would, you know, get all charged up, never having any contact with any poor people, any blacks, Hispanics, minorities, etc. But they would say, because I'm a liberal, I need to do. And this is what this film is about. You could have said this was black. You could have said it was Hispanic. You could have said it had been about homosexuals. It could have been any minority. It could have been. And it's more about the reaction of how whites usurp things that they perceive as being a cultural trope towards a particular group and just adopt it because they think that's the way that should be to show that you're not bigoted.
Topped off by the moment in the film where the three white writers say we need to listen to more black voices and outvote the two black people in the room.
Yes.
Which was very obvious, but still worked. All right. So my number 6, I have The Holdovers.
I do not.
Well, you were at number 5.
Yep. I'm at Zone of Interest. Even though I love the film, I had The Holdovers higher.
Okay. So then 5, I have The Zone of Interest. So we can talk. We have The Zone of Interest at the same spot.
Yep. It was a difficult film to watch and enjoy because part of you just wants to scream, like, what are you doing? How could you do this? But that's the part that really is significant.
If I'm going to break down the film, I'll just say by putting it in the 5 spot, part of this is, even though I think there's a lot of the film that I missed and I haven't been able to, or I haven't had time because I've been trying to fit in a lot of the movies in the lower categories this week in preparation for this. I think there are a lot of things that I missed, partially because I'm American and because I had to try and then read, watch, and then try and hear. You're engaging multiple things that you're trying to do. And so there are just nuances to the film that I think I missed while I watched it the first time. And in essence, this is just a film that I respect what it accomplishes, but there are pieces of it that I didn't quite grasp, maybe went over my head. We were talking about it yesterday. The ending for me, I think, is maybe a little bit too heady, that I just didn't quite get the dry heaving in the stairwell cut away to the futuristic. And I know this is a big spoiler, but the futuristic flash forward into the museum, I don't quite understand what he's trying to do with that. And so maybe if I grasped the parts that I'm supposed to get out of this a little bit better, the flourishes, then it might connect with me on the emotional level that I think the people that really love this get. And so it's at 5 from a respect level for what this movie accomplishes, the subject material it does, and presenting something, because we've gotten so tired of the Holocaust films. And I don't mean to put it that way. Obviously, the Holocaust is something to be appreciated in all of its horror, but we've gotten so many Schindler's wannabes, it's gotten stale, and this does something different. And while the Holocaust is somewhat on screen, it's more off screen than it ever is. So it took a subject matter and gave us additional nuance past it, which I respect. It's just, I think I'm still missing the part where the light bulb goes off for me and I get the film. And that's why it's at 5 instead of probably higher.
As I've made the comment, when we're talking about Nazis, and, you know, it's easy for us to say, well, how in the world could it, you know, the German people have been taken in by Hitler and his cronies. And a book I read a few years ago, and I'll do a plug, Eric Larson in The Garden of the Beasts, he portrays how the interactions of Nazi Germany in the 1930s with the American embassy and the American ambassador and his family. And it portrays and it shows you how these people were had normal lives. They went and had dinner with people. They had friends. They had cocktail parties and parties in general. And they had, you know, so they had were charming. They were social. They had solid relationships. They were normal people. But there was a dark side that didn't come out. And so these people could easily be manipulated or taken in by their normal behavior. And I think that this film portrays that, how easy it is to just see the positive aspects of people, or that they don't show their hidden dark sides. And so to me, that's why this film is great. But it is very subtle. This may rise if I have a chance to see it again. I've only seen it the one time. But it was hard to decipher exactly. But I think if I watch it again, it may rise. But I think 5 to me was about the point that I thought it should be at this point.
If we were to come back to this in a couple of years, I think more than likely it probably is a little bit higher. But as of right now, digesting it with only one viewing and not necessarily having it click in the way that I thought that the other 4 films ahead of it did more for me, then yeah, I think this is where it is. All right. Number 4. What is your number 4?
I have Anatomy of a Fall.
Okay. I have that higher.
Okay.
So my number 4 is Past Lives.
Well, I have the holdovers for my number 3.
All right. So we've now both gotten holdovers. Mine was at 6. Yours is at 3. This might be the first time that we've really had that level of variance in our list. We're obviously going to get to one where you had it at 10 and I have not yet said it. So I have 3 things left where it could be. So it's in my top 3 and it's your 10th. But I like the fact that usually in most years we agree on almost everything. This is one where we haven't. So the holdovers, first impressions, or what would you like to start with?
This spoke to me because this is my time for period. This was more within the realm of where I was back in the 80s and 90s. And, well, 70s, 80s, and 90s. I had teachers that were Paul Giamatti in this film. But yet, I was kind of the oddball kid, surprise, surprise, who had connections and made relationships with teachers and administrators and staff people. I had more connection. I could see myself being the kid. I could see myself dealing with the teacher. You know, I just felt connected to this film, unlike a lot of films. And the one that we're talking about, which was my number 10, I had no ability to connect to it. I didn't understand it. But I think this is ultimately a film where our age difference is what really makes a difference.
And that's very possible. The one caveat I would have to that is I think for the most part, as the emotional favorite, The Holdovers is maybe number two for a lot of people. I know that there are a lot of people that connected with it. I just wasn't one of them. I think it's a fine film. I enjoy Paul Giamatti. I had nothing difficult to say on it. Maybe it's, again, another one where I'm a victim of my own expectations going into it. I thought I would love the film. And in that way, I was maybe a little bit disappointed because I thought it was okay.
We come at things in two very different ways, which is I come at it from somebody who started with nothing and had to traverse through life and figure stuff out and deal with it. I had lots of adversity. You didn't have a whole lot.
Nope. I'll admit that.
So even though the kid in this film was from an affluent family, he had to deal with a lot of shit and he was struggling with it. And that's what really makes it eye-opening is you realize how difficult his life is, even though he has money, because he's struggling to exist with this broken family and having a father who cannot provide emotional and parental support to him. So it's not just an age, but it's a perception based upon where we started, I think.
And sure, that's reasonable for me to think about. To me, I think there are individual performances that I think Giamatti's a very good actor. He's very good in this. Obviously, I said Divine Joy Randolph should win the Best Supporting Actress. I thought Dominic Sessa as the boy, again, was good. I thought the writing was good. But on the whole, when you add all the parts together, there's just nothing for me to connect with. There's no perspective that I see in myself. It doesn't feel, I don't know, connective to me in any way. And I can appreciate the film, but I just don't see myself necessarily returning to it.
Okay.
All right. So you had your three at The Holdovers. My number three, so we can finally talk about it because you've been itching to do so. The film that you finally watched just today, but that I specifically went into the theater thinking it would be my number 10, putting the expectations so low so that I might enjoy the film, and coming out of it and thinking that was the most I laughed in an individual film in, or at least in the theater all year. And I thought of the year of the supposed feminist movies where we saw Barbie be the outstanding champion. I thought Poor Things, my number three, was the superior feminist film.
Yes, I agree. It was a feminist film.
Okay. All right.
After that,
go on your war path. I'll clear out and let you go.
Okay. I watch a lot of film. You watch more at this point than I do, obviously, but it's time limits and such. But I didn't connect with it. I don't understand it. It's so artistic and it's so over the top. I mean, I think that I just at times was going like, what's the point of this?
All right. So let me interject one moment here in the discussions or the conversations that I've had about this film, because I have one friend. Okay. The two guys from the Revisionist Almanac, I'll plug them here. All right. Friends of mine. I talk with them multiple times a day, every day. Andrew Corns and I are somewhat on the same level. Adam said the minute that Willem Dafoe belches a bubble was the minute he knew this film was not going to be for him. And everything that you're saying makes me think that you are on the exact same wavelength as Adam.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, what the fuck is that?
I also thought that, but I didn't necessarily like completely say, oh, no, immediately when it happened. It was just like, that's weird.
Okay, no, I don't immediately go, oh, that's film's over for me. I mean, I will at least start, but I'm going, I don't have a clue. I don't know what this is supposed to be telling me. You know, at the end of the film, yeah, okay, I got it. That she, it was all about her finding herself. And yes, it was a feminist film, but I just had so much trouble watching this and trying to find anything redeeming in it.
Okay. You satisfied?
Yeah, I've had enough.
All right.
The box office will prove me correct.
All three of these films that are my top, I thought were outstanding. I love them individually for multiple reasons. And I thought they clearly, all three of these separated themselves for me for what I felt coming out of the theater. And usually my initial gut reaction coming out of the theater tells me a lot more. It won't for my overall number one this year, which was a movie that I will get to, but I had more complicated feelings coming out of that film when we did the first time, but it, with subsequent rewatches, has greatly improved for me. That's rare. Most of the time, I just rely on my gut, much in the way that I did for our tiebreaker, to tell me whether I really connected with a film. And for whatever reason, a film that I would have never thought would have connected for me in Poor Things just worked. It did. From a nuanced perspective, I think the first act where we have the innocence of a child disrespecting all of the barriers and the niceties and the politeness of our society and just running through them because you've inserted the brain of an infant into a grown woman. And the dinner scene where she just says the most obnoxious things because she has no social graces at all and just runs through them. But she's still learning the way of the world, and the innocence of a child looking at all the structures we put on ourselves and just saying why, to me, opened up the film.
Yeah, you mean like going up to somebody in a rest stop and looking at them in their car and saying, you should quit smoking because you're going to die.
Yeah. Little boys like that.
I won't mention which little boy did that, much to his mother's horror, and I'm laughing.
Well, given the family history of lung cancer due to the cancer
chain
sex.
Smoking that's existent in multiple generations of the Duncans? Oh, I don't know.
I don't feel too badly about doing that one, even though social graces would now just let me walk on by. But even so, I think for the first half of the film, and where this movie really engages and is really funny, is in those moments where she has no concept for why we would do things in a certain way because she's never learned these rules. She never went to a proper school or etiquette that we all just take for somewhat of a granted as you grow up because you have to make the mistakes. She's making the mistakes in real time, but everybody expects her to be an adult. And that's just not the thing. But it does point something out about the just farcical nature of all these structures that we placed on ourselves that really don't mean anything. I mean, what she's doing, other than the scene where she was about to punch a baby, with obvious reason, that would be a problem.
Yeah, okay.
But everything else, just kind of
ever thought, oh, if I could just punch that baby.
Well, if you're like on a plane and there's been a baby crying for the last like 2 hours. Yeah, everybody's had that impulse. I don't as much as other people because I can somehow compartmentalize and not worry about it. And thank God for noise canceling headphones nowadays.
Oh, yeah.
But even so, I also enjoyed the nuance of her in the brothel and finding her own power. And then this character that's supposed to be this all self-important, self-aggrandizing, male, manly man, Mark Ruffalo, the god of sex. And then he's, by the end of the film, become a groveling puddle who's resorting to bringing her ex-husband around to somehow get back at her, but then like break up a marriage so that he can... Every part of this weird movie, and I understand it's weird, and if you don't buy into the aesthetic look, which I normally don't, you're just not going to buy the message of the film, but there's so many little parts of the film that I just enjoyed for where it progresses through her story, which is why I thought Emma Stone's Best Actress nomination and why I thought she was the best this year, because it's just, a tour de force. As much as everybody like lauded Cate Blanchett last year as being like the true, she is now the greatest actress of our generation. Emma Stone's coming for you, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I come at these as I'm not an art or a big artistic auteur film watcher. I ultimately look at films and I judge them based on, do I enjoy the film? Is it entertaining? Do I like it? Is it funny? Does it have a good pace? Whatever. And sometimes I'll go and point out the artistic aspects of it and feel it on a higher level. I'm not one of these snobs who's looking at it. And this film did not connect with me at all.
And that's, I guess, maybe my disappointment, because while I went into it with very, very intentionally low expectations and came out loving it, I was hoping that if I tried to set the bar extremely low and say, you're going to hate this movie, you're going to hate this movie, you're going to hate this movie over and over and over and over again until you finally saw it, that maybe you'd come to like find the redeeming quality in it that I did. So it is a little disappointing to me, but it's also to a degree what I expected.
Okay. I am what I am. I'm, you know.
It honestly, variance is the spice of life. So your number okay. two, sir.
My number two is Past Lives.
All right. Let's talk about it, because it was my number four.
Okay. The reason why I had this as number two, when you said we should watch this, I was apprehensive because, again, it's a foreign film. It's a Korean film. I'm thinking this is going to be, again, something I don't understand. There's going to be all these subtitles. I'm going to have a hard time following it. I think we were watching it on a Friday or Saturday night when I have a tendency to be, you know, being a 60-year-old man, a little more worn out. And the more I'm watching the film, the more intrigued I am and the more drawn into the story. And by the time it was done, I'm going, this is such a beautiful, clean, well-done film about something that is so beautiful, which is just pure human connection and how people move on with their lives and have difficulty going from there on. And I just absolutely loved it. And the more I get away from the film, the more I love it. Because this film, even though it's a story of immigrants and there's nothing about this that touches me as who I am, a middle-aged white guy from the central United States, it touched me in the fact that we all have these relationships. We have connections. We have people in our lives that we had younger. And as we've moved on, and every once in a while, they'll come back into our lives and we try to reconnect with them and we can't because we're no longer the people we were when these relationships started. And as a result, even though they hold a special place in us, and in large part, they define who we are and create the emotional and psychological basis of our existence now, we can't go back because other things have happened that intervene. And this film just laid that out bare. And, you know, the simple fact that the end of the film, and if you haven't seen it, I would actively encourage you to watch it. But at the very end, her crying over the fact that she has this connection yet, but realizes that things have just gotten, they've moved along, and this is a path that she can't go back. There's no way to retreat from where you are at the present.
I think due to past relationship scar tissue, the ending of the film peters out more than ends with a thud that it does for other people. And I think that's the only reason that it's not higher for me, is there's an inaccessibility of the moment that's supposed to be the most resonant. I really enjoyed the film. I appreciate the film. I felt that it was a very, very good film. It just didn't quite have the same high that I got from the three that I had above it when I came out of it and said, oh, this is one that I know is going to be a top film of the year for me. And so it has everything up to that, except for whatever reason, the ending doesn't hit me in the way that I've heard everybody else talk about it, whether it's you or any of my film community buddies. It lands just outside of that top three where I thought those were different films for me.
My last two high school class reunions, the one that I think it was my 35th, I happened to run into a girl that I had such a crush on in junior high and in early high school. And I finally got to sit down and have a conversation with her and to tell her how much I loved her at that particular time. And it kind of like closed this open wound that I had from my adolescence. And then each of the last two, my 35th and my 40th, I run into a guy that I went to class or high school with, but I had a strange relationship with his younger sister, and how much of me wanted to go up and just say, how is your sister? Or what's going on with your sister? What's her relationship? And I never could. And to some extent, that kind of I regret that, because maybe it would have resolved one other emotional or romantic wound that I have. So this film really spoke to me about resolution of those open wounds that we all seem, or many of us seem to have. Obviously, you've just said you don't have them as much, but those open wounds. I'm not sure that's...
No, I disagree with that characterization. I think I've tried to close them up and scar them over, that it's hard for me to reaccess that to the point where it connects in that way. And I think the scar tissue gets in the way of me having that same connection. Even though I've now said on multiple occasions that certain movies have touched me in such an emotional way that I've had a tearful reaction to them. I don't know why. I can appreciate that everybody else did. I did not. I've now watched it twice, and it just, that scene just lands. And then I'm like, okay, that's the end of the film. So again, four in this particular year, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. I just, for whatever reason, had the other three higher.
Okay.
There's a certain gap between the top three and this one. And I think if I were to point to anything, it's that moment. All right. That was your number two. So then I obviously know what your number one is. My number two is Anatomy of a Fall. So let's talk about it.
Yep, that was my number four. Go ahead.
So we basically reversed two and four. Again, going back to certain scenes within this one, I don't know if it worked at every single moment of the film. There are a couple of spots where it dragged, but I watched this interspliced between the national championship game for college football. I remember watching this and coming out of it and saying, oh my God, that was a great film. Again, going back to how it initially happens, the little interplay with the boy between his mother and then the like court-appointed caretaker, her little scenes with the lawyer where you're not really sure of what the relationship or the nature of that are, how they never really explain what actually happened. So you're left to kind of fill in the blanks yourself, much like you're on the jury trying to decide her fate. The way they reveal parts of the relationship, but also are so careful at saying this is only one part of an entire relationship. Given the nature of which I've seen how many couples fight in a very similar fashion and have these knockdown dragout things, but that still have a good relationship outside of this. They fight, but they fight productively. this may not be one of those, but it just hit home for me in a way that I didn't really have for most of the other films. If there was one where it just hit me like a ton of bricks coming out of it, that I didn't have to build up expectations. It was like the surprise thing. And when we did our New Year's recap or our yearly recap with the Revisionist Almanac earlier this year, the live online thing that we did, and they asked, what's the movie you're looking forward to next year? And I said, the one I have no idea about. This is the kind of film that I'm talking about. It's the one that I turn on because there's a reason to turn it on. It's going to be an Oscar nominee. And okay, it's a French-German film. I don't know much about it. I know the title. And oh, it won the Palme d'Or. Okay, let's turn it on. And I think I had Triangle of Sadness as like my number 9 last year. So that was somewhat of my headspace thinking, oh, this will be something that I have to watch in stages because like I can't watch it straight through. It's going to be too heady for me. So let's put it on during the middle of a football game. And yet I think I was more interested in the movie than I was in the football game, which knowing me as a sports fan is a rare occurrence. So when I talk about the film that I have yet to see that's going to really surprise me, this is the kind of film that I'm talking about. And even though I am so ingrained, which is why I love 12 Angry Men as much as I do, but with the American court system and analyzing court tendencies and how we adjudicate things in this country, the stuff where you have the differences between the French court system and how they structure things, and even the placement of the prosecutor versus the attorneys and where she's on the witness stand, and then you have the other witnesses and you have these weird cross-examinations where you'll have the witness on the stand, but the prosecutor's simultaneously asking questions of both the witness and the person who's on trial. And then you have the judge. Even all of that was so very different from all the almost cliche American courtroom scenes that we get in TV for Law and Order and all these other things. None of that bothered me. And I know that you're going to say, because you said it after we finally finished the film for you, that did separate. And I think that's going to be the thing that, for like me with Past Lives, that moment in at the end where it doesn't connect, I think that's the thing preventing you from loving this as much as I do. You can respect and enjoy it, but I think that's why we trade places on those two films at 2 versus 4. I didn't have any hindrance from that and still appreciating what I thought was justice of the film. And Hulaire is fantastic. The little boy is fantastic. Even the prosecutor, who I hate through the course of the film, is fantastic in this film. And so I thought this was a revelation. I love this as my number 2. It's not my number 1, but this is a fantastic number 2.
For me, and you hit on the point, the biggest problem I had with this was just this bizarre court process that I had a difficult time with. Not the fact that we had very subtle points where people all of a sudden in hindsight go, oh, I should have saw that, or I should have understood that, or I should have realized that. That was great. But the trial work was so different for me. I mean, I've had 150 juries. I've tried homicides. It just struck me so difficult for me to follow that this was being allowed, that I had a hard time following it and accepting it.
So let me ask this as a follow-up. I thought for sure when you said that comment coming out of it, you'd have this much lower. So I'm surprised to have you at 4. What is it about the film that has it at 4 despite your connection or lack of connection in that way?
The parts that were like the revelation, the child going, you know, maybe my dad, that's what he was talking about. It's that subtle aspect. You know, we've had situations where we've had people in our lives who have behaved or who have died under either self-inflicted situations or bizarre situations, however you want to It's like suddenly things come to us that we're like, I didn't see that, or I didn't think about that. And how our inability to perceive things as they happen in real time, but in retrospect come back, that's what struck me. That's the part of the film that I thought was so provocative, intellectual, and poignant. And so that's why I went with it as high as I did, simply because I don't remember a film having that level of subtlety as to these little things that kind of tip the balance. But as it is, you come out of the film and you're going, well, I know she was acquitted, but is that really what happened? And that's what struck me, because the number of times where I've had a verdict and I'm like, I don't know. You know, I mean, I always said that if I do my job, the prosecutor does his or her job, the judge does his or her job, justice will provide, will be obtained. And then you kind of start back and think about what, you know, was that really accurate? Was that really what happened?
And that's why I think the last 10 minutes of the film with the aftermath, which is not something you see in most court movies, like A Few Good Men ends at the basically the end of the verdict and them getting off and they leave the courtroom and it's done. They end it right there. To me, where the extra added impact of this movie is trying to reintegrate into normal life, seeing that, okay, I won the verdict, but my life doesn't like feel congratulatory or more meaningful. It's just, I can move on. I don't have this other thing weighing over me anymore. I don't have to go to prison. I can spend it with my son. But what kind of life do we lead now? That to me was additionally impactful in a way that you don't see in most court movies.
Yeah. Ultimately, she was acquitted that they couldn't prove that she did it, but that doesn't dispel the fact that a lot of people think she did.
And I think there are so many layers to this one. I think I will return to this multiple times over. I think this is an exceptional film that requires repeated viewings. And I was so impressed and blown away with this thing the first time I saw it that I can't sing it highly enough. But that leads to, if you've been following along, you know that we have only one film left for each of us, and it's the same film. And for the third time in 4 years, we will have the same number one film, because go figure, we're often like-minded. We're, of course, going to settle on the same thing. It's Oppenheimer.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking should win and will win, we both have this as the number one. This will be our prediction for Best Picture. You said coming out of the theater that you thought it was the best film of the century so far.
Yes.
And I was much more muted. It was a film that I really appreciated, and there were individual performances. And while I still don't have it as Nolan's best film, I think I have it probably number two, which is weird for me to say because I've revered so many of his films. He's been my favorite director for a while, with the exception, of course, being Tenet. This is a movie after the third time. It took three viewings for it to go from a movie that I enjoyed and respected to a movie that I revered. I could finally see the inner workings. It was like Oppenheimer himself finally seeing the subatomic particles come together and understanding them. There was just this light bulb where it clicked and all of the parts went together. From a casting standpoint, from a cinematography standpoint, from a production design and technical effects and visual effects score, this is almost a one of one. The entire cast, I didn't even recognize it was Josh Hartnett in a predominant role in the film.
Yeah.
Jack Quaid for a throwaway part, a Safdie brother. And I don't particularly care for their movies, but to make an impactful role in the middle of this movie. I don't know why a 3-hour talking biopic about nuclear weapons? Is this engaging? Is this almost universally approved as being the choice for Best Picture? It's been the front runner since like September, and nothing has dented it at all. But from Downey to Murphy to Blunt to Nolan to every technical aspect that goes into it, it just works. It sings. It's enjoyable. It doesn't have down moments. It has nuance. It puts an important historical figure on trial for everything that he did in his life and says, this person was important, but they were also flawed. They were great and did accomplish marvelous feats, and yet had all of these sins and these dark parts that we don't want exposed. And it does everything that a biopic should do if it's actually done well, and that I criticize all the other biopics for doing poorly. It excels in all those aspects. And I just have to recognize part of my reverence is an appreciation for doing well where all of these other dreadful biopics do poorly. And so if there was a double feature for this movie, it's almost watching any one of the abominable biopic dreck that we've gotten for years. Just put that on first, sit through the 3 hours of maddening visual Wikipedia entries that we get, and then watch this movie and tell me it's not the one of the best biopics ever made.
I go into a film with absolute open-minded acceptance of what I'm seeing, hearing, feeling, experiencing. And I try not to prejudge or be critical of any aspect of the film while I'm watching it the first time. And at the end, I start sorting through in my guttural reaction how I feel in my soul about a film. I know that sounds stupid when you're talking about old school or dodgeball or something. But again, it's an aspect of just I've had to teach myself certain things. I've had to experience certain things. I've had to learn about life, about the world, about culture, about society. And I think I'm pretty wise and experienced. And so I just let the film, or for that matter, artwork, music, and I just want to experience it for what it is first. And as time goes by, I'll wait a couple or a few days, a few weeks, and start letting it kind of ruminating in my mind as to what I'm thinking, if there's any variations or differences. But I ultimately determine that my first reaction to a film is pretty darn close to what I'm ultimately going to think about the film. And as I said, as you pointed out, I walked out and said, I think this is one of the best, or is the best film of this century that I've seen, simply because it has such relevance politically, emotionally, historically, psychologically, artistically, that we have had. And there's nothing about this film that ultimately changed. In fact, there are portions of it that wedged into my soul more. It took the second time for me to really appreciate how really good Emily Blunt was in this film. It took me a second or third time to understand the little nuances and to really be able to decipher exactly what Cillian Murphy was doing in this, that he had that ability to convey arrogance and apprehensions and self-doubt at the same time. That just made me appreciate the film more. it tends to be more about me being able to explain my original visceral reaction than altering or changing that initial opinion. And this film has done that. It's going to be a long time, I think, before I find a film that I have more connection or appreciation with than this one.
And I think that's, for the most part, a good place to cap it for the year. It's been an enjoyable year. I don't know if I place this year necessarily in the moment on the pedestal that some others do, particularly because some of the films that they laud, I'm not quite as high on. But let's read back our individual lists. Can you go from 10 to 1?
Poor Things, Maestro, Barbie, Killers of the Flower Moon, American Fiction, Zone of Interest, Anatomy of a Fall, The Holdovers, Past Lives, and Oppenheimer.
And for me, 10, Maestro, 9, Barbie, 8, Killers of the Flower Moon, 7, American Fiction, 6, The Holdovers, 5, The Zone of Interest, 4, Past Lives, 3, Poor Things, 2, Anatomy of a Fall, and number 1, Oppenheimer. So, 4 years, we started off part one of this, recognizing that it's been 4 years. This is our fourth annual preview of the Oscars. We've been doing this for 4 years. This is season 5. We have a lot of exciting stuff planned. I think I might have mentioned already, I have all of season 6 already mapped out because I'm a crazy person.
Yeah, well, we know that.
If you would like to guest spot on anything, I don't think anyone's declared. And I'll lay a hint. There's a big franchise coming up in the middle of next year with a big anniversary.
Yeah. So
just a teaser in there. If you want to get in your guest spots, let me know. GreatestAllTimeMoviePodcast@gmail.com. But
you kind of implied that, you know, we should do a category or a thing called questions you want to ask Dana.
Yes, I was going to say Ask Dana Anything will be a new upcoming segment on the show. So you can write in your questions to either our email address or at Gmote Podcast on Instagram, Letterboxd, TikTok, X, YouTube, any of those places, and start submitting questions. Please refrain from some of the like more piercing and personal and profane questions. But
well, I might answer them anyway.
Well, within reason. I know you're no stranger to necessarily doing some of that stuff, but like I certainly don't want you answering questions about your very graphic and intimate sex life on the podcast that I have to edit eventually. Like, I don't want somebody writing in, for example, what color underwear does my mother wear? That would be bothersome to me, to say the least. But anyway, it has been an enjoyable 4 years. I enjoy the Oscars just about as much as anyone else, even though I know this has lost cultural significance. And part of the reason is we can do a 2-part, 3-hour plus connective episode on appreciating 50 some films that I've put a lot of time trying to consume all of these things and share a passion project with somebody I care a lot about. And so it's been enjoyable. It doesn't feel like it's been 3+ hours, but it definitely has. And so, Dad, thank you for the 4 years. Thank you for doing this with me. It's been another enjoyable year. I look forward to doing this again next year.
As do I. And we have a few other little things, nuances. I come from a little city in Wisconsin called Beloit. They have an international film festival, and we'll be attending in April. And I'm hoping that we can do some things that may interplay and create a little additional content for the show from that as well. So there's things that we're looking forward to and I'm enjoying. And this has enriched my life immensely. And I appreciate it more than I can say.
So before both of us have more waterworks to display, Thank you very much to all of you out there who went through two parts this week. We appreciate you very much for staying with us. Thank you for listening. I asked you a simple question. Do you love her? Yes, but don't hold that against me. I am a little screwy myself. Next week, for our 203rd episode, we discuss the first ever winner of the Big Five Oscars with It Happened One Night from 1934, celebrating its 90th anniversary. Directed by Frank Capra, written by Robert Riskin, starring Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. You won't want to miss that one, so watch ahead of the show by searching The Real Good app to find where it's streaming for you. That's R-E-E-L-G-O-O-D. Please like, follow, rate, and review, or whatever on whichever platform you have so that more can join in on our fun. You can also email the show at theNewRonnieDuncanStudios.com or at GreatestAllTimeMoviePodcast@gmail.com or find us on YouTube, Instagram, X, Letterboxd, or TikTok at the handle at Gmote Podcast. The Greatest Movie of All Time is a production of Ronnie Duncan Studios. Our show is mixed, edited, and written by Thomas Duncan. Our music is thanks to Purple Planet Music. Our technical provider and distributor is Captivate FM.